Thank you so much. Yes, I am Glenn, if we haven't met already. I'm from Australia, but I've lived half my life in the UK now. And so pleased to be with you. I've been interviewing people with very interesting stories all week. And we've talked about city success and banking high flyers. And we've talked about anxiety and depression. And we've talked about losing loved ones. And this afternoon... It's been a long week. This afternoon we're talking about the pain of losing a child. And we're here with Tracy. And you are among friends, aren't you, here?
I am. I'm very lucky. I'm so blessed. I've got so many lovely people in my life here today. So I've got my school mums over here. I've got my lovely friend Angela. I've got my church posse. I've got my family and friends, Debbie. And my mother-in-law's carer. There's a whole range of people here, and I'm so grateful for you coming, because I am feeling a bit scared, obviously, opening up to you all about a kind of private but painful part of my life.
Right.
But also I'm aware there are several people in this room who've lost a baby or babies, and I hope this isn't too painful for you, but hopefully something might come out that is of help to you.
Yeah, well, you're very much among loved ones. And Tracy wants you to know that she has given me permission to be nosy.
Yes.
Yeah. Can I do that?
Yes, you may.
I'll ask nosy questions on your behalf, and we'll get into some very sensitive, very raw areas. And you've also given me permission to be, in your words, lordy, lordy. So I'm Charlie Church here. Tracy will bring the reality. And I can bring a bit of Bible stuff at the end.
Absolutely.
Is that all right?
Well, I'm aware, you know, often, you know, when you talk about being a Christian, it gets very jargony, and my heart really goes out and sensitive to that. So, hopefully.
Okay. I'll bring the lordy lordy later.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So, Tracy, you kind of grew up in a sort of church-going home and that sort of thing. Was that part of life to begin with?
Yeah, absolutely. I was very privileged in that I was brought up in a Christian home. Both my parents were. Actually, my father wasn't initially, but my mother was very much... a strong Christian. I come from a really big Christian inheritance. You know, my grandparents, my great-grandparents, my aunt, and now my brother were all missionaries in Africa. So, I was brought up in a Christian home. Mm-hmm. We used to go to church every week. My mum used to take us faithfully, me and my brother and sister, to church every Sunday.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
At that point, my father wasn't a Christian. And I kind of went through the motions. It was very happy memories, mm-hmm. you know, Sunday school. It was all kind of okay.
Yeah, yeah. And if I'd parachuted into your life age sort of 18 and I said, so Tracy, who is Jesus to you? Like, what would you have said, do you think?
At the age of 18?
Yeah, let's say that.
At the age of 18, I'd completely revolted against it.
Okay.
Around about 13. In fact, my dad quoted this in his wedding speech. I went through the revolting years. And I was revolting. I mean, in every sense of the word... I was drinking, smoking, lying, doing everything, mm-hmm. you know, I guess that you hope your 13-year-old wouldn't do.
Mm.
And I just totally turned my life back on church. I just didn't want anything to do with it.
Yeah. And yet, were there any thoughts about Jesus? Like, if I had have cornered you and said, yeah, I know all that revolting stuff, but, like, what do you make of this guy Jesus? What would you have said?
Yeah, that's a really good question. If I had a gun put to my head, maybe I would have said something like, I had a deep-rooted, sort of vague seed there, I think.
Hmm.
Because all my family around me were Christian, you know, and I thought, well, kind of, they can't all be stupid. If they all believe in this, there must be something involved in it, you know. Hmm. All my aunts and uncles and cousins, and so I guess... But yeah, I was much more interested in enjoying, having mm-hmm. a good time, doing my own thing, going my own way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So yeah.
Okay. And what was your maiden name?
My maiden name was Gilbo, which is Gibor in French.
Okay.
And when I gradually became a Christian, we'll talk about that in a minute, I was often renowned as not Tracy Wilde, and I was always renowned as, you know, Peter and Elizabeth's granddaughter. Oh, you're Simon's mm-hmm. sister, because all my relatives were very involved in the church.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then you became a wild woman.
I did become a wild woman.
Okay. Did James turn you wild?
Yeah, exactly. Wild by name, wild by nature.
Okay. How did you meet him?
I met him when I was teaching at Caldecott, a boys' prep school.
Okay.
Yeah.
Who liked who first?
Well, that's another good question, because to this day we can't agree.
I thought you were about to say we don't actually like each other. Okay.
It was a drunken snog one night, and we still can't remember or acknowledge who went first.
Simultaneously, then.
Exactly.
Isn't that nice?
Yeah.
Yeah, your lips locked across a crowded room. Yeah. Okay. And so you got married in 99, is that right?
That's right. 99. We got married at 99. At the school where we work, it was a wonderful day, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Really hot day, all our friends and family there, it was pretty cool. Yeah.
Yeah, happy times?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I was still kind of doing my own thing, going my own way, you know, great fun times. This was a long time ago now, it was 20 years ago.
Yeah, back in the 1900s.
I know.
Yeah.
Thanks for that.
So, and then you wanted children to come along fairly soon, or what was the plan?
Yeah, I think we didn't rush into it. I mean, James did very well because he was a cradle snatcher. I'm 8 years younger than him, so he did well.
He did well.
So I didn't really think about it initially, but then we sort of got our heads around it and thought now might be a good time. So, we started trying for family, and then we had 3 years of infertility and sadness and issue over that. And eventually I had endometriosis, and that was diagnosed, and I had that treated, and then, we fell pregnant.
I fell pregnant. You fell pregnant, and how did that feel?
Yeah, it was very, very exciting. Very exciting, as you do.
Yeah, yeah. Any sickness, any kind of, no, it was just, you bloomed?
Oh, I don't know about that. I didn't really do the whole pregnancy
thing. You don't do the
bloom,
yeah,
no.
Okay, yeah. No. Yeah. No nonsense.
No, I didn't really. I don't think I did. It was, no.
Yeah, yeah. Don't do any of that nonsense. That's great. And then you told us a very, very tragic thing just earlier today. At 38 weeks, you went swimming as normal. And that was part of the routine.
I really took care of myself with my pregnancy.
Yeah.
I used to go swimming quite a lot. And I do pride myself. I did not have a single drop of alcohol through my pregnancy. So, because, you start afterwards thinking, what if I'd done this? What if I'd done that? And I'd just gone for my regular swim. And I came home. I came home and some French friends of mine had come over for lunch. And I said, we've just got this routine midwife appointment. You stay there, we'll be back in 15 minutes. Left them with getting lunch ready. And we went to down to the doctor's surgery, and my hideous midwife at the time, I won't name her, but she was hideous all the way through my pregnancy, just did the routine Doppler thingy. And I was going to say she went pale, but she was dark skin. So she looked uncomfortable, and she panicked and said, you need to get to hospital. So we got in the car, we drove to hospital, and obviously I had a sense that something was wrong. I was a bit panicky. I got on the phone to my parents, and even though I didn't have a faith then, I remember I think I said to Mum, you need to pray, something's wrong. And then we got to Wickham, and we were taken up to the delivery ward, and they scanned me, and I remember at that point seeing the screen and seeing the baby, but the baby wasn't moving, and then they said, I'm really sorry to have to say, but there's no heartbeat.
What's that like, to hear those words?
Oh, I can't really remember now. I mean, it was just disbelief and shock and numbness, and it was total disbelief. And weirdly, I can remember saying and thinking at the same time, when can I have another baby?
Wow.
That's kind of a bracket. I don't know why. It was just all very confusing.
Yeah. Who was with you at that time?
Just James and I.
Yeah.
James and I. So, I can't remember that piece, but James took me back to my parents, who were in Burn at the time, and we rang them on the way home. Well, James must have rung them and said that, it's bad news, we need to come around. Went back to my parents' house. I went and sat on the bench at the bottom of the garden. And the first thing I remember doing was I sent James out to get me a packet of cigarettes. I hadn't smoked through my whole pregnancy, but I just was... I needed a cigarette, so I had a cigarette. I was sitting there on the bench, and this little robin came and sat with me on the bench. And my mum cooked a supper. It was very surreal.
Mm.
And then we had to go back home, pack a bag to go back to hospital, which was very confusing because I had a bag packed for me and a bag packed for the baby. And I was like, what, a bit crazy. So I sort of took one baby grow and a nappy. Well, I won't need a nappy. Is your phone ringing?
It might be,
I can't
yes.
I know.
Isn't that terrible? Shamed.
That's hilarious.
Shamed.
Can't believe
if your phones are on, I would advise you, under pain of death.
That's so unprofessional.
Anyway.
Just sitting there. That's brilliant, I got you. Anyway.
Where were you?
Yeah. Where was I? So, yeah, I had to go pack a bag. Randomly got a bag together. We went to hospital. Again, you know, hideous. You're admitted to the delivery room, the labour ward.
Right.
So you've got all these people around you and crying babies and screaming, and you're put in this famous left-hand room. My friend wow. Jane's here. She'll remember this room. And it's and Julia. In the left-hand room where they put the people, couples whose babies have died. Mm. And then we had to start the whole labour process.
So you were induced?
Yes, I was induced. Mm. Yes, I was induced. And they explained, because my first reaction was, get it out.
Mm.
You know, I didn't have this association with a baby yet, so I was like, get it out. There's a dead baby inside me, get it out. And they explained to me that actually that's not the right thing to do. You need to give birth psychologically in terms of the start of your healing and in terms of your physicalness, and if there's such a word, physicalness, and in terms of future pregnancies.
So a long labour?
I can't remember. Yeah, it was over a day and a half or something.
Oh, my goodness.
But no pain. That was one thing they did. You know, I said, look, I'm going to deliver. They gave me spinal blocks and whatever else. No pain.
You knew you were having a girl?
No, I didn't.
Okay.
So whilst this was going on, James, you know, was saying, well, what are we going to do? What are we going to give this boy or girl a name? And so we decided that it was helpful for both of us to have a name for either a boy or a girl. And so in the end, James chose the name Robin because it was a friend of his growing up. Because we needed a name that fitted both girl and boy, obviously, because we didn't know. Oh. And this is one of his friends from university who'd taken his own life, but he was really close to. And also because of this Robin on the bench moment, and it just felt right. So from that moment, she was Robin before you even knew if she was a girl or boy.
Why do you think that's important? Because one of the human instincts would be, like you said before, I've got a dead baby inside me, get it out.
Yeah.
So part of you is thinking, I want to detach from this.
Yeah, totally.
But to give her a name is to very much attach. Why was that important?
Oh, this is one of those questions I'm going to ask you to help with. Why was that important? Well, yeah, I mean, this baby was my daughter.
Right.
You know, was part of me, part of James. It was part of the bonding process, I guess.
Right.
I don't really know.
Yeah, yeah. She was yours. And,
yeah.
And she should not remain an it.
No.
She is real. She is your daughter.
I need to show you a photo of Robin at this point, actually.
Yeah.
I don't know if we've got a photo of her.
Yeah.
I was worried about doing this because it might be too sensitive, but I'm proud of my daughter. I don't know if you can put it up, guys.
Yeah, are we ready? I'm asking the people in the room. Are we ready to see Robin? Yeah, we've got a proud mum. And we want to see a beautiful daughter.
I was worried about it. We weren't sure about whether to do it. This is Robin. I mean, you know, my precious Robin. She obviously had been in my tummy, had died in my tummy 2 or 3 days before she was born. So her skin is a bit peely and she's a bit red and her lips are a bit red. But, you know, that's Robin. She was born at 7:05 on the 24th of July 2004. You can see that's a picture of me. I mean, even though she's dead in my arms, it's still a photo of a proud mummy.
Do you remember that photo being taken?
I do. My mum was with us through the whole time, and she was the one that pushed for it. Because at the time, I didn't want it. And she pushed for it and took these photos. I think there's one more of James and I and her in that infamous room.
Huh.
Both of us looking at our daughter, obviously, the tears, the pain, the anguish. And the real overriding word for me was confusion.
Right.
I was so confused by the whole thing.
Right.
Because here I had my lovely daughter, and We don't need that slide yet, guys. Sorry.
Yeah.
So then we had her in our room for a while and cuddled her and talked and cried like I've never cried before. Yeah. And then they took her off and put her in, I guess, a cold room. Don't know what they do with them.
Right.
And then brought her back to us the next morning.
Okay.
And we said goodbye at that point, and then we left the hospital.
What was the worst part?
That was probably the second to worst part. The second to worst part was leaving the hospital literally empty-handed.
Hmm.
I'd arrived with a baby in my tummy, and I'd left with a flabby tummy, still in my pregnancy clothes, but with no baby. And we got a taxi to pick us up. And if you know Wickham, you go down the hill, round the roundabout, and back up the hill again. And it was just like, and the guy, the taxi driver, obviously picked us up for maternity, and he was asking us stupid questions.
Oh, no.
And we were just like, shut up.
Right, right.
And then the second worst part was when my milk came in 3 days later. It came through at 3 o'clock in the morning, and my boobs were enormous, you know, and of course, the milk had nowhere to go.
Hmm.
And I remember curling up in a ball in our bedroom, rocking up and down, just not knowing what to do with myself, the agony and the anguish, and obviously your female hormones. It was just the lowest point of my life, I think.
You mentioned about your cab driver saying that, you know, the wrong things. There are a lot of people here in this room. We want to comfort people who are going through horrible situations. What are the bad things to say? What are the good things to say? Is there anything that can be said?
Well, I've learned through this, you know. I mean, I used to be, I still am. I mean, we're all sinners, aren't we? But I've learned through this to try not to be judgmental, because you have no idea what sort of stuff people are going through. Hmm. And so now I'd never ask anybody, is this your first? Or, you know, have you got any other children or whatever? Because you just don't know what's going on in people's lives.
Yeah.
In terms of what really helped me was people talking to me and acknowledging her and asking me about her and allowing me to talk about her, because even though she wasn't alive, she's still my daughter, very important to us. Those of my friends and family who are around me know that. We've got photos of her all over the house. We talk about it. My little niece is here today, Sadie, who's 3. Happy birthday, Sadie.
Happy birthday, Sadie.
And, you know, they all talk about Robin,
yes,
you know, with their children.
Yes.
So it's a kind of death is open in our families.
Yes, to the point where you had a funeral for Robin.
We did. We had a funeral. I can't remember the date, but it was about a week later. James took charge of that. That was his part in the grieving process. He put together an amazing service, and she was buried. And she's buried in Marlow, but we had the service in Cookham. Mm. And yeah, again, that was hideous. You know, in the hearse. Is that the word? Car.
Mm-hmm.
We had Robin in between us, this little coffin, and then he walked down the aisle holding Robin. Again, all very surreal.
Little coffins are the worst objects
yeah.
in the world.
Yeah, they are.
To see a little coffin.
And now she's buried in, you know, this little part of the cemetery in Marlow where all the babies are buried.
Mm.
It's sad.
And today, if I ask you, so how many children do you have? What do you answer?
I know, well, that's a particularly difficult one for me, for many reasons. But depending on the people, I will answer differently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How long before you tried again for children?
Well, again, that's an interesting one. And my friends who are here who've lost babies will relate to this. Because where's Jane? My lovely friend Jane here. I might start crying now. My lovely friend Jane, she lost Charlie and Toby, twin boys, around about the same time as Robin. And we met at the Child Bereavement Trust. We met this amazing lady called Jenny Thomas, who became our bereavement counsellors, and we met at this sort of counselling session, a group kind of thing, where we had to do these sand statues. It was all a bit naff, but anyway, I remember sitting next to her, and I remember turning to her and going, is it wrong that I want another baby straight away? And she went, oh, I'm so glad you said that. So do I.
Right.
And again, when you talk, I call them my dead baby friends, but I must find another name for it, because that's not really great. But when I talked to my dead baby friends, we all had the same feeling, didn't we, of just wanting to have another baby. And it wasn't because I wanted to replace Robin, but there was this maternal longing.
Mm. But you'd had 3 years of trying before Robin.
Yeah.
So did you fall pregnant again?
I think we did, and then
yeah.
it was terrifying. You know,
I'll bet.
It was absolutely terrifying. I was
yes.
up at Wickham Hospital, not Wickham, because I couldn't go to Wickham because it was the association. At Wexham every 5 minutes in the fetal assessment unit being monitored. I was
right.
panicky, and I made it through to 36 weeks with my daughter Amelie and 37 weeks with my son Archie, and they did an early cesarean in both times because I just couldn't go there.
Yeah, yeah, and that was a conscious decision. Let's not go to 38 weeks.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And healthy deliveries and...
Hideous. I mean, you know, let's be honest. They were both cesareans and horrible, and I felt them both. They said that if I'd had another child, they probably would have had to have knocked me out because I felt it. Mm. And again, not easy. Millie was on the Billy bed. Is it called a Billy board? Billy bed, the blue light thing, because she was in jaundiced for a week. And Archie was in special care for a week because he was out too early. So he was in the, it's again, a very terrifying part.
Right.
And we're asking the consultant, you know, is he going to live? And, you know, they weren't able to say it initially because you can't, because you don't know, and the whole suing thing. But in the end, because of my story, he did stick his neck out and say he is going to live.
Okay, okay. So you've been on such a roller coaster, and I asked you, aged 18, you know, where is Jesus in all this? And you'd had your revolting years, and then you've had the worst tragedy it's possible for a mother to imagine. Yeah. So,
where did I go?
What did Robin make you think about God?
Well, it was a sequence of events, really. Mm. So, my parents came to this church, and actually my sisters did as well, as young children. They used to go on all these summer camps and stuff. Mm. But I'd never been. I'd come on Christmas Day and stuff, I think. And having lost Robin, I was feeling very angry, very confused, and I was thinking, where is she? And I was drawn to come to church. So James and I came to church. We sat in the back row in the old days, and there were pews. We sat in the back row and wept the whole service. Mm. And Will was preaching in the pew, which used to be up here. Mm. And he's a monkey, isn't he? He clocked me. And he was talking, I don't know what he was talking about. And one of the hymns was, Great is Thy Faithfulness. And I remember standing up and thinking, this is absolute crap. Yeah. Great is Thy Faithfulness.
Talking about God's faithfulness through all things.
What's this about? You know, right. My daughter's died. What is this about? And I felt really angry. And we got up to leave a bit early. And Will, being Will, ran down the driveway and caught us up with us and, you know, found out who we were. Hmm. So that was the first sequence. And then he came round to our house, as only Will can do, because he's very persistent. He came round to our house, and I was sitting outside with James. He did this whole two ways to live thing.
Okay.
This two ways to live is like a little way of helping you to understand the whole Christian message about two ways to live, either yourself being in charge or letting Jesus be the ruler of your life. And he did this thing. It's a little six drawing thing. He did it on a scrap piece of paper for us and then went off. And I remember James and I thinking, you know, that's a bit surreal, a bit of a lecture. What's that all about? So that was the second sequence. And then the third sequence was that literally the next night, I woke up at 3 o'clock in the morning. This was Saturday, the 4th of September, 2004. Actually, there's one step before. I then decided to go on the Christianity Explored course here, which I'm sure you'll plug because that's your gig, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I came into the Christianity Explored course here and had loads of questions, obviously. And during this process, I woke up, as I said, on the 3rd of September at 3 a.m. in the morning with the words, Matthew 3, verse 8. Matthew 3, verse 8. And it just kept going round and round in my head, Matthew 3, verse 8. And I couldn't get back to sleep. I tossed and turned. What? I swear this happened, Matthew 3, verse 8. So I went downstairs eventually. I was wide awake, and I found my Bible. This is the Bible that my parents gave to me on my confirmation, on my baptism, on the 23rd of March, 1985, to Tracy on her confirmation from her mummy and daddy. And I am the way, the truth, and the life. And I picked up my Bible, which you can see has had a bit more use now. And I opened up the Bible, and I swear on my life, it fell open at Matthew 3.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the verse, produce fruit in keeping with repentance, which is Matthew 3, verse 8. And I've written it, underlined it in my Bible, and wrote the date. And I was like, what the heck is this about?
Yeah.
So I went back to bed, and the next day I phoned up Will, persistent Will, and said to him, you know, what's this about?
Mm-hmm.
And he tried to explain it for me.
Mm-hmm.
So it was taken from a passage in Matthew where John the Baptist, who was he?
He was like the forerunner to Jesus, preparing the way for Jesus, pointing to Jesus.
Exactly. Yeah. So he was amongst a group of the Jewish leaders, and they were all professing to be really, you know, strong Christians and all this sort of stuff. And he basically said, "Oh, you brood of vipers, you're all hypocrites, in that way, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
You're all hypocrites.
Yeah, yeah.
And what you need to be doing is being true to yourself, to turn around, to accept your failures, turn around and repent and come towards me." Mm. And so in order to produce fruit, mm-hmm. you need to keep, in order to produce fruit to be, what's the word?
In order to be fruitful, you need to repent, which is to turn back to Jesus. And
I'm still trying to figure that out, Glenn. And it's still, you know, it still puzzles me. And I'm still, I'm still trying to figure that out. And I, you know, I have so many questions still. I have my doubts.
Right.
And my pattern of my life, I'm sure lots of you can relate to this, is that I kind of go my own way for a while, do my own thing, this is fun, you know. Mm. And then something happens, and usually a catastrophe or something, and then I turn back, come back to Jesus, and surprisingly, I start to produce fruit again. And that applies in my marriage, in my friendships, in my parenting. And I truly believe that it took such a tragic situation for me, given my character, my nature, and my stubbornness, I describe Robin as my wake-up call.
Wow. But why turn back to Jesus? Like, because if there's a God who can allow that to happen, surely that's a God you should turn and run the other direction from. Like, why would this make you turn to God?
Well, you know, it's a source of comfort for me. When Robin died, I was like, help, where is she? You know, and I thought, she's got to be somewhere. Yes, she must be in heaven. She must be in heaven. And these sort of childhood memories came back. And a deep, deep sort of hidden faith, I guess. Mm. And I thought, right, so if she's in heaven, then I can no longer pick and choose what I believe in. This is ridiculous. I need to investigate it.
Okay.
So that's when I did the Christianity Explored course. And okay. I looked at the details. I looked at the evidence. And I made a choice. And at the end of the day, it's about making a choice.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's not an easy choice, and I find it difficult living that way sometimes, and I don't always get it right.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah.
Yeah. Let me ask you two final questions. One of them's going to be a bit of a lordy question.
Oh, gosh,
just
okay.
So you know. Just brace yourself. Now, with what you know from the Bible, and we've all got questions, I've still got loads of questions, but how do you practically put together a good God and the kind of suffering you've experienced? How do you put together suffering and a good God?
I still find it very difficult to understand.
Hmm.
And certainly if people ask me that question, I'm like, help. That's the question I need help on.
Yeah.
But I do believe that God exists. I've investigated. I do think it's true. I look at the world around me and creation and, you know, the intricacies of baby making and all this sort of thing. And ultimately, I do believe that when we die, there's eternal life. And there has to be hope, surely. There has to be a reason or whatever. And I do believe now that this is a lordy question. Mm. You're going to expand on this, aren't you?
Yeah. Yeah. Let me do the lordy stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know if did I answer that?
That's good. Yeah, that's good. Well,
I don't think I did.
I think if you embrace Jesus, he allows you to make sense of how horrible losing a child is.
Mm.
In a really deep sense, that if there isn't a good God, then what happened to you is just unfortunate.
Yeah.
You just got unlucky. Whereas I think you know, and I think everyone in this room knows, what happened was wrong. Mm. Unconscionably, intolerably, horrifically wrong, right? But if it's wrong, there must be something that's right. Do you know what I mean? You know, does that resonate at all?
Yeah, it does.
Yeah. And so if someone wants to investigate, as you said before, if someone wants to look into these things, like, what advice would you give? You can either give us motivation to look into these things or practical steps on how do you take it forwards. What advice would you give to someone wanting to look into these things further?
Well, there's loads of things, really. I mean, the first is, here's a classic advertising moment, isn't it? Which I guess you'll do too, is the whole Christianity Explored course thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Which they run here at church once a term.
Yeah.
really non-threatening, unheavy environment. You go along, listen to stuff, it answers really big questions like, you know, what about pain, what about suffering, which I find difficult to explain, but who is Jesus, what's it all about, science, all those kind of topics. And as I said, I did it about 3 or 4 times, and I still have questions. I think we all do, you know. So that's one way. That's a really unthreatening thing to do. Talk to a Christian friend, maybe. I've got some seriously amazing Christian friends in this room who have walked alongside with me and continue to walk alongside with me, because it's such a journey and it's such an adventure and it's ongoing. Come and check this church out. It's really normal. I mean, you know, not all Christians wear sandals and A-line skirts and, you know, whack you on the head of the Bible. We're all kind of normal. And what else?
That's good.
Is that a good start?
That's like 3. That's amazing. Amazing.
I know. Wow. I'm doing well.
Get you. Are you going to be around afterwards for a little bit if people want to catch up and chat?
Yeah, sure.
We've been so appreciative of what you've shared with us, and I think your openness will allow us to think and to process these things with honesty, because you've been honest. So thank you so much
for doing
that.
Thank you very much, Glenn.
Let's show our appreciation for Tracy Wilde.